You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
It's January 2001. A U.S. spy plane is flying over the South China Sea when a Chinese fighter jet pulls up.
One's right there. 10 o'clock. You're going to pass in front of
us. You're going right in front of us. Same altitude. All right.
It gets close.
Whoa, we got bump.
Felt that one.
We got bump.
Really close.
It's close. I agree. Go
and he's very, very close.
Oh, yeah.
He's almost probably 20 feet from our wingtip. So he's inside of our wingtip.
This isn't new or even rare. Just one more move in a cat-and-mouse game that had been building for some time between the U.S. and China in the disputed South China Sea.
K-90, where is he?
90 has decreased slightly in altitude, still trailing, 630, maintaining his distance.
Ooh, this guy's having a little bit of problems. He's squirrely, not real steady. Oh, yeah, he's having problems. Okay, he's moving out a little bit. He's falling back. 9-2 is falling back.
But this close call in January 2001 was a warning of more danger ahead. I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. This is Face Off. Over the next 8 episodes, I'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Plus, I'll speak with insiders in both the U.S. and China, along with analysis from renowned China historian Rana Mitter.
Oh, yeah, he's having problems. Okay, he's moving out a little bit. He's falling back. 9-2 is falling back.
Months after that first close encounter in January, a Chinese fighter pilot again buzzes a U.S. military spy plane. It seems to be the same pilot. His name was Wang Wei, and he's in the same area, not far from the coast of China. It's April 1 now, a sunny morning. The American pilot, 26-year-old Navy Lieutenant Shane Osborne, is about to head back to base in Japan after many hours peering into China from international waters. It was a routine flight for him and his crew. But as the Chinese fighter jet approached, the flight became anything but routine.
I could see him right out of our cockpit. He was like 10 feet away.
This is Osborne recounting that flight in a Frontline documentary.
I'm looking over to the left, looking right in his face, and I was like, this isn't good.
It wasn't good. The Chinese pilot, Wang Wei, proceeds to inch closer, then peel away. Once. Twice. Osborne and Wang could see each other, eye to eye.
And when I heard him come the third time, I had an eerie feeling. I was like, I knew, you know, you just knew he was going to hit us because he wasn't stable. He was all over. His plane's mushy, flying that slow.
The planes collide. The American nose cone shattered. A propeller was damaged. One of the engines stopped working.
The plane just shook violently and we kind of pitched up and I heard a pop and that was his nose hitting ours. Then he shot off to the side and we were upside down. I was looking up at the ocean, but it was violently shaken and I could hear the wind screaming through the plane. It was not a good feeling. I was pretty certain we were dead at that point.
Wang ejects from his plane. The Chinese jet plunges into the sea. As for Navy pilot Shane Osborne,
finally, we got lucky. I put full power on the other three remaining engines, and we were still screaming out of the air. It wouldn't hold altitude up that high with all the drag, so it took to about 8,000 feet before we could hold altitude. So we started out at 22.5, and it was 8,000 feet before we were flying again. It was a rough day.
A rough day indeed. And that was just the start of it. Osborne radios for an emergency landing on Chinese soil. No response. With few options, he makes the decision to make an unauthorized landing on the island of Hainan at a Chinese military base. This starts an 11-day ordeal in which Secretary of State Colin Powell and U.S. Ambassador to China Joseph Prier negotiate with their Chinese counterparts to get Osborne and his 23-person crew home. It was a diplomatic feat, and one, I'll argue, that would not happen today. China is a different country now. It's much more powerful. The United States is a different country now, too, intent on staving off the challenge from China and keeping American primacy. The two nations are clashing over who is in charge of the world, and tensions over the South China Sea are at an all-time high.
Are we going to have another war, be it in the South China Sea or in Taiwan Strait?
This is Zhou Bo, a senior colonel of the People's Liberation Army, speaking on CGTN, a Chinese state news organization based in Beijing.
I believe actually in South China Sea, it is more dangerous. Why? Because American ships and aircraft keep coming. Yeah. So there are indeed dangers of getting too close to each other, to trigger an accident.
An accident that could catapult the two superpowers into dangerous territory. For more perspective, I turn to retired Admiral Scott Swift. He commanded the U.S. Pacific Fleet in the South China Sea from 2015 until 2018. We first met when I was based in Beijing for the New York Times. He was actually responsible for a huge amount of territory way beyond the South China Sea. And I wanted to talk with him about what would happen if there were an accident in those skies today.
Yeah, I think that's the core question, Jane. The critical point is, how is it different in 2001 and how is it different now? We don't have Ambassador Prier, who was a naval aviator that brought his experience directly to bear in the dialogues about resolving the challenges as opposed to deliberating over what exactly happened. Let's set that aside for a future time. Let's move forward, which is what he and other leaders were able to do. That's one point. The second point is, we don't have the communication mechanisms in place to allow that dialogue to occur between Beijing and Washington. And the third point is, the international environment is so much more pressurized. And the fourth point is, both governments, our government environment is so much more pressurized. On the Chinese side, it's where their economy is. They've got significant international issues. And of course, we're aware of the challenges that we have within our U.S. government.
So for the reasons that you just outlined, four very clear points, the Pentagon has been doing some war games on this very question that we're talking about, a reprise of the collision 20 years ago. What would happen if it happened today? And one of the things that would happen if it happened today is high likelihood that the American plane could sink in the South China Sea. All crew on board are gone, disappeared, presumed dead. And then, according to this game, there's a mighty race between American ships and Chinese ships in the area to get to the crash site first. And because the Chinese have more ships, they could well get there first and stop the Americans getting there, and or they could try to stop the Americans on the way, ram their boats as the Americans head towards those waters. What do you make of that scenario?
That's very problematic.
What does that mean?
I could see that if the airplane went down in waters, China claims as territorial waters, they could make the case that the U.S. can only enter into those territorial waters unless invited. Instead of turning this into a rescue operation, they could turn it into a sovereignty operation. And that's why I say it becomes very problematic.
By sovereignty operation, you mean they would claim that the American plane went down in Chinese waters. The United States considers the South China Sea, like other parts of the world's ocean, as international waters. But China takes exception to that when it comes to the South China Sea. They believe they have historic claims on the South China Sea, going back centuries. So you could interpret their close encounters, they're getting very close to American planes, as a way to say to the United States, Get out of here. This is ours.
Yeah, so I want to be very precise in my language because I think we lack precision. The U.S. doesn't feel that all of these waters are necessarily international. They recognize that some of these waters are sovereign waters. But what is uncertain is who owns the sovereignty. And using historic claims as a declaration of sovereignty does not comply with the international rules-based order. There's a lot of details that are involved in there I won't get into. But the voiceover from the Chinese side is the U.S. activities are destabilizing the region. And if the U.S. would just comply and understand the sovereignty claims of China, then the situation would resolve itself. That it's completely within the U.S. power to resolve these frictions. And of course, that's where the impasse begins, because that is not a realistic perspective.
I mean, doesn't China make it a little bit difficult for the United States in this sense? When Xi Jinping came on his state visit, very elaborate state visit to Washington in 2015, which is the same year that we met in Shanghai, he said on the White House lawn, at the urging, as I understand it, of the administration, China will not militarize the new artificial islands that we have created in the South China Sea. And then he went home, and they started to build runways, and they've put planes on those islands, so you could say that they have militarized them. I guess my first question would be, why did the United States not try and stop China, either through diplomacy or through other means, from gaining these assets in this South China Sea?
Hindsight's 2020. I think most people agree that the U.S. could have been more committed early on to make it very clear that that wasn't to be tolerated. But we've seen it in Europe. We've seen it, not to change the subject from the South China Sea, but it's relevant. You know, with the Ukraine issue, we saw foreshadowing of what was going to happen in Ukraine and Georgia. And there was a lack of action, in my opinion, in Georgia, and that emboldened Putin to act elsewhere, which was Crimea, as well as Syria, as well as Africa. I mean, this is not unusual on the international stage. I think what's different here, what's important about this conversation that you and I are having and others are having as well, is that the consequences are much higher. Look at the consequences in Ukraine compared to the outcome in Georgia and the outcome in Crimea. And I think the consequences that potentially the South China Sea and elsewhere, where these frictions that are policy frictions between the United States and China are playing out, especially in the military domain, the magnitude that a crisis could generate is significant. I think a miscalculation between the U.S. and China, two of the strongest international powers with huge economic stakes beyond the military stake, this is very, very significant. And I applaud the effort that both governments appear to be stepping forward to try to re-engender the mechanisms that we have to control to allow de-escalation to occur if things escalate.
Just before we get to that, I think it's important to understand a little bit about how, and I'm not trying to beat up on China, not at all, but China is a hugely growing economic power, and they're spending a fair amount of their military, just as the United States does spend a lot on its military. And one of the areas where they're spending a lot on their military is in shipbuilding. And one keeps reading that China now has more naval ships than the United States. Can you explain that and maybe explain why that's important? Maybe it's not important. Maybe numbers don't count.
I think numbers do count. I am in the camp where I'm more realistic about what do the numbers mean. So just the fact that you can stack up a bunch of numbers doesn't mean that it directly correlates to an increase in influence or an increase in power. I think allies and partners are important. Who is drawn to your national view and your international view? I think that's a strong indicator. It's a major weakness that we see in Russia. And I think that's a challenge that China faces today in the region. Their messaging is to people that are close to them, that share borders and share interests in those areas that they're trying to influence, trying to ensure that they stay on the sidelines. I think they've given up on trying to gain them as partners. Their partners are Russia, North Korea, Iran, you know, others. So that's part of the power equation. But numbers are significant.
So I want to bring up the subject of aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
China is now testing what is called, well, its fourth aircraft carrier. It's supposed to have more bells and whistles and be far more advanced than anything they've put to sea before, and they're about to start sea trials. How advanced is this new aircraft carrier? And anyway, does it matter? Because some people say that aircraft carriers are yesterday's weapon. Does it really matter that China has a really cool aircraft carrier?
You brought up a really interesting point, Jane, and that is the primacy, in my words, of carriers from a U.S. perspective. I mean, carriers are still critically important. It is consequential that China is pursuing carriers because it sends several messages. One is they can. It takes a huge industrial base to support the production of carriers. It takes a huge national commitment to recruit the sailors with the skill sets necessary to operate day and night off the carriers. Having said that, it takes a huge amount of direct experience flying off of carriers to optimize that platform as a complete weapon system. But China is nowhere near that point yet.
How far off do you think? You know, so they've got this fourth carrier. How long will it be before that's fully operational and able to compete with America's 11 carriers?
France can't do it now, and they've been doing it for decades. So I don't want to put a timeline on it, but it will be a long time before the capability and capacity of their naval strike groups comes anywhere near to what the U.S. is. But it's not one thing. I don't rest confidence on that. Look at where they are with hypersonics. Look at where they are with the missile force. Look at where they are with cyber. So in saying that it won't happen in my lifetime, the parity between a China carrier strike group and a U.S.
I think you're going to live much longer than that, Admiral.
What's that?
I think it's going to happen. You're going to live much longer than that. Come on.
We're talking decades. You know, hopefully it'll be longer than in my case, but it's going to be a long time before they reach that point.
So what you say makes me think of what you have told me in the past, that you believe China is now a peer competitor to the United States. That isn't the position of many in Washington. Why do you think China is America's peer competitor?
When you start to rack and stack the competition out there, I just don't understand how you can logically characterize China as anything other than a peer competitor if you're talking about them in a holistic place. Now, I've got many friends who are much more experienced than I am in the European domain, but I would not characterize Russia as a peer competitor to the United States. They don't have the economy, they don't have the central power of their governmental system. Putin is weak in many ways. He can't control his population the way that the Chinese can control their population. Those are all elements that go into this calculus of what is a peer competitor and what is not a peer competitor. Now, if you're talking about a peer military competitor, that's different. You're separating it out. But if you're just talking about a general strategic peer competitor, China is clearly a peer competitor. And I think we put ourselves at some risk by not characterizing them as such.
You mentioned President Biden and Xi Jinping meeting and agreeing to, quote unquote, formalize talks between their two militaries. Do you see these talks really formalizing anything very much?
I do. The reason I feel that way is it's got to come from the top down. From the top down on two pillars across both of our governments, statements that are made publicly by government officials, statements that are made by talking heads, for lack of a better term, think tanks. That whole atmosphere has become so charged. Without two leaders coming together and saying they're concerned about what we've been talking about, and they recognize that having channels for conversation in times of crisis is extremely important. If we can't have them in fairly benign conditions like we have now, I get it, that's very arguable to characterize them as benign. But if we can't have them in the situation that we have now day to day, how are we supposed to have them in periods of increased tension? That is a very powerful message to send.
So one level of these talks that have been agreed to will be between commanders of China and the United States. You were a commander, an American commander in the Pacific Ocean and in the area that includes the South China Sea. What were your Chinese counterparts like? What is it like being in talks with your Chinese commander counterparts?
So I was the Pacific Fleet Commander, and I was responsible for all naval forces, Navy forces in the Pacific. I had a Marine counterpart that was in charge of Marine forces, Army, Air Force, and so on. So my conversations were at that level. They were much easier conversations to have then, I think, than they are now. So I wouldn't want anybody to walk away to think that the conversations I was having then would be the same conversations we're having now.
How would you guess that they're different?
Well, first of all, they're not happening. That's how they're different. I don't think they're going to be happening between the Pacific Fleet Commander and the Pacific Fleet counterparts. I think they're going to be happening at a more senior level. So, and that's important because these are policy issues. The military, I didn't do policy. I was a military expert.
You ran the boats. You ran the personnel. You ran the sailors. You made sure they behaved. They got to port.
I followed and criticized policy. That was my role. But the Secretary of Defense makes policy. That's why those conversations are so important. They can really make things change. Our presidents do not want a tactical incident to occur in a strategic dilemma for both countries to deal with.
You're basically using fancy language for saying they don't want American and Chinese military planes to collide over the South China Sea. Is that what you're saying?
You mentioned a point earlier about the probability of something happening. I'm less concerned about the probability of a collision. The probability is there. I think there are things we can do to reduce probability. What's different now is the consequence of it. I'm not sure even an Ambassador Prier could find an off-ramp that he was able to construct. We live in a different world now, Jane. If you put me back in that position today, I would go into those initial dialogues with ears and eyes wide open and mind wide open. It's very difficult to have a conversation with Chinese counterparts today.
So it sounds to me, Admiral, that we should be cautious about how much talks, military talks between China and the U.S. will go and what they will do to prevent another serious accident in the South China Sea. We should be cautious about it.
I have two things to say about that. One is we need to be pragmatic but realistic. We should look for these opportunities. That's what I mean by pragmatic. But we should be realistic about what the rate of change might be going forward. And the second point I would make is process is more important than product. So when people say, what do you hope to accomplish? I think an appropriate answer is, I don't know. We all want products. We want something that's delivered, both sides. What's important is the process that's laid down. And that gives me hope.
Looking beyond the specifics that we've been talking about, how do you look at the future of the relations between the two countries? And what do you see as the most pressing questions?
Well, I worry most about a tactical trigger. I think the pressing...
By that you mean?
A specific issue that... Something that happens. A U.S. citizen seized by the Chinese government. You know, we've seen this with Canadians. We've seen it with others. That would... I'm not sure what a resolution to something like that looks like. It could be a collision that we talked about. It could be any number of things that... You know, I haven't spent enough time imagining what the potential is. I'm criticizing myself and lack of imagination that I think. That's one concern. The other concern I have is that there is, I think that when I talk to my Chinese counterparts, they don't say this directly, but indirectly, there's a real concern about what the trajectory of the future power of what China will be going forward. And we talk about the Davidson year, the 2027 as being, you know, the year that they feel that the PLA will have the power to forcibly reunify Taiwan with China. I'm less concerned about that. I worry more that China could move much sooner than that if they feel that they have to. For international reasons or national reasons. I think we've got a 10-year window. I agree with people that characterize as the next 10 years as being critical because it's so unpredictable. Who can define where the trajectory of the United States is going to be from a government perspective in the next 10 years? I'm not worried about that. I'm a true believer in liberal democracies. I'm much more concerned about Xi Jinping being able to follow through on his strategic initiatives of continuing to grow the Chinese economy and lifting so many of the Chinese citizens out of poverty and up into the middle class. I worry more about the fall of China than the rise of China. We should make it clear that a strong and vibrant China that complies with the international rules-based order is in the world's best interest. It's got a huge economy. And we can change the international rules-based order where they don't like it, but we have to change it through discourse and dialogue, not force and coercion. That's the core of the friction.
You make such an unusual and, I think, very telling and totally absorbing idea that the fall of China is more serious and more negative for American interests than the rise of China. How do you see this fall of China scenario under Xi Jinping?
I don't know. I'm not an economist. Go talk to economists. But I'll tell you what drives the fall of nations is war. We turn to war when we've given up on diplomacy, when we've given up all the other instruments of national power, and we decide we're going to beat each other up until our power base is gone. We saw it in World War I. We saw it in World War II. It's the approach that was taken in Vietnam. It's the approach that was taken in Korea. So when you talk about the fall of nations, pit two militaries against each other and take the leashes off of civilian control, what you're driving at is forcing the fall of the other government before your government falls. That's why this conversation is so consequential. But we need to elevate it above the military. The military piece that we've been discussing is very important because it could be the trigger. But we need to be very careful that we're not reaching for that as the solution. The solution is diplomacy and statecraft.
Thank you so much, Admiral Swift. It's a pleasure as always.
Thanks, Jane, and thanks for all that you continue to do, not just with this podcast, but your continued engagement in the region.
Admiral Scott Swift commanded the U.S. Pacific Fleet from 2015 until he retired in 2018. Coming up, renowned China historian Rana Mitter will join me to break down my conversation with Swift.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm joined now by Rana Mitter, my good friend and great China historian who always has a thoughtful take on what's happening in the region. So, Rana, after listening to Admiral Swift, what are your first impressions of what he had to say?
Well, there were two things that stood out for me, really, Jane, in that conversation. One of them was something that I do hear more and more, which is that it's really important to have channels of communication. It's important to have a safety valve that means that Beijing and Washington can talk to each other, particularly when an incident threatens, like the EP3 incident, which could spiral out of control. That's one lesson that's been learned. You must keep the channels open. The other thing that he said, which was in some ways a little bit eyebrow-raising, was to abandon a phrase which, you know this, Jane, you hear it often from people in Washington, D.C., New York and elsewhere, which is the idea that China is a near-peer competitor. And he seemed to be saying, no, it's not near-peer, it is a peer competitor. In other words, start treating China, well, you could say as an equal in that sense, not in terms of values, not in terms of the way in which the U.S. thinks about China in the international community, but in terms of that military aspect, essentially saying that when China does what it needs to do, it essentially has the capacity to match or come very close to matching the United States. I thought that was a pretty big claim. What did you think?
I certainly do, and I think it will send shudders through the corridors of power in Washington, where they're doing their best to try and keep the United States ahead of China, or trying to argue that the United States is ahead of China. and that the United States will defend its primacy in the world at all costs. So what Swift is saying is really quite radical, and hopefully it'll give some thought to the people in Washington who are arguing otherwise.
There's also, I think, another question, which is the way in which the states of the Southeast Asian region, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Vietnam, actually decide to play their cards. In other words, although I think that there is certainly a very strong feeling when you talk to diplomats or ministers from those areas that they want the area to remain calm, that they're not looking to favour either China or the United States, nonetheless, there is also a sense that they are weighing up constantly who has the upper hand. If China is in a position to essentially say, well, in practice, we control this area, it may mean, slowly but surely, that the level of US influence, along with that of its allies, Japan, South Korea, and others, may begin slowly and surely to diminish. So in some senses, this isn't a static issue, it's a very dynamic one.
Thanks, Rana. This is just one of the many issues between the US and China. Around the time Admiral Priya was smoothing over this explosive situation, one of America's most valuable companies was beginning its intricate and symbiotic dance with China.
It's time to go beyond what a smartphone can do.
On our next episode, we go deep into the marriage between the Chinese Communist Party and the iPhone.
This is iPhone Pro.
Thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to Face Off anywhere you get your podcasts. And while you're at it, give us a review. This project is made possible by the generous support of the Carnegie Corporation. Face Off is produced and reported by me, Jane Perlez. Special guest, Rana Mitter. Executive producer, Mia Lobel. Senior producer, Nina Pozuki. Sound design and mixing by John Myers and Alex Lewis of Rohome Productions. Original score by Alex Lewis. Show art by Good Tape Studio. Research by Luz Ding. Special thanks to Frontline, Paul Bogards, and Maggie Taylor. Special thanks also to the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School for their support.
Rohome Productions.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.